Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday, the third day of March, and we are thrilled to have you on the program. It was hopefully you all had a good weekend. It was some beautiful weather. It got a little cold there, but it was beautiful, and I hope you enjoyed it and got out and had a good time. Because Friday was just nuts. Friday was a weird day, and I'm talking about news-wise and otherwise. I wasn't here Friday. I had a colonoscopy, which was fine and all acceptable and all was good. But I woke up from the anesthesia, and one of the first things I saw on TV was Trump berating Volodymyr Zelensky. And I figured I was still under. and then as I realized I wasn't, I wished that I could go back to being under. Anyone who has had anesthesia for a while, you know it takes you a little while to clear your head. So I took a long nap. I got up and I tried to figure it out, and I still couldn't figure it out. So we have wonderful guests this morning who will help us try to figure all of this out. We welcome you, the listeners, to join us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We welcome public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois to the program. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Well, other than what happened on Friday, you know, doing all right, see change in our country. But I want to say one real quickly, little announcement.
Yes. Okay.
Stand up for science. This is Friday. People keep saying to me, well, what can we do? What can we do about what's going on in the world? Well, one of the things you could do is on Friday, nationwide, stand up for science. So if you're concerned about the cuts at NOAA for the weather, stand up for science. If you're concerned about the NIH cuts at universities, you can stand up for science, or agriculture research or health research cuts. So there's going to be a focus this Friday, March 7th, in different ways in Washington, D.C. and around the country. So.
This comes after the economic protest of not spending money on Friday, last Friday. So,
right. So there's something you can do.
All right. Thank you very much, Teresa. We also welcome political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. Hello, Libby.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm all right.
All right. Good to...
Libby's standing up for science, right, Libby?
Yes, but I'd like to sit down for science, which means I need your chair. Because...
Oh, we can switch.
Could we? Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. I didn't.
I have to have my feet on the floor.
Oh, you don't have your feet on the floor there?
No.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, we'll do it quietly. Y'all talk amongst yourselves while we sit.
All right. Very good. We welcome.
It's the little things in life that
make
a difference.
I know. So, Libby, thank you very much. UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies, Jennifer Burns, is with us. Good morning, Jennifer. What a delight to have you with us.
Good morning. Always happy to be here.
And, I will tell you that just earlier last week, we were scheduling this next gentleman to be on the show, and we were going to have him in for a segment today to talk about his new book and an event that he has coming up in our region. And then Friday happened. The title of the book is A Liberal Vanguard, Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia. Ding, ding, ding. This is exactly what we want to talk about today. Professor Emeritus of Comparative Literature and Russian at Hofstra University, Alexander Mihailovich, is with us. Mm-hmm. And I thank you so much for being here. You've worked at Williams College and Bennington College and Brown, and it's an absolute delight to have you before our microphones on this Monday. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay. So let us begin with what happened on Friday and the blow up, or I shouldn't say the follow up to all of that of what we've seen over the last several days as a result. Before I go on, Libby, your feet are on the floor? Okay.
Yes,
good.
I am. Thank you very much.
Just checking. We're good. We're good. Here's what we know. There was a showdown. There's a lot of different words for it. Smackdown, showdown, insult fest, confrontation, outburst.
Set up.
Stupid.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yes.
Spectacle.
Spectacle. All good words. So The question is how Zelensky's Oval Office meeting turned into a showdown with President Trump just hours before President Volodymyr Zelensky of Russia, of Ukraine, sat down with President Trump in the Oval Office on Friday. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina dispensed some advice to the Ukrainian leader. Don't take the bait, he said, encouraging him not to get into a spat with Mr. Trump. I said, don't get into arguments about security agreements, Mr. Graham recalled on Friday evening in a brief telephone interview with the New York Times as he sat aboard Air Force One preparing to fly to Florida with the president. Mr. Zelensky did not silence his concerns during his meeting with Mr. Trump, who has come to expect a level of capitulation from almost everyone who has met him since Election Day, from foreign leaders to billionaire business executives. The result was an extraordinary dressing down, another term, by a U.S. president of a foreign ally in the middle of the Oval Office while the media's cameras recorded it all. The question hovering over Washington on Friday evening was whether the confrontation was a spontaneous outburst or a planned verbal smackdown by Mr. Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance, neither of whom respect Mr. Zelensky. But three people with knowledge of what took place beforehand said neither Mr. Trump nor Vance had been looking to blow up a deal for Ukraine's mineral rights, which they did do, which Mr. Zelensky had been expected to sign in Washington. He didn't. Instead, they said Mr. Zelensky seemingly triggered the two American leaders by not sufficiently thanking the United States for trying to end the war. I will pause there for my reading of the New York Times article about that event. So, Professor, what should we make of this from your point of view? Was this at all a surprise? Was President Zelensky going to get anything out of this meeting?
It was not a surprise for me. I was expecting Zelensky to turn down this so-called mineral deal for a number of different reasons. But the main one was that there are no security guarantees included in the mineral deal. Now, I was surprised by the form that it took, that it was as theatrical and grotesquely flamboyant as it was. I think that the problem here is that the Trump administration absolutely did not want to commit militarily at all to providing a security guarantee. They initially said that, we are not interested in providing security because that would mean boots on the ground. But let me just add that that's not necessarily the case. Merely providing additional military aid would have been probably the measure of a security guarantee that Zelensky was interested in. I just want to backtrack a little bit in regard to what happened two weeks ago in Riyadh, yes, where there was where Trump, Putin, and the Riyadh hosts put together a so-called peace conference that did not include Zelensky himself. And Zelensky, of course, commented on this, you cannot expect any kind of viable peace deal about the Ukraine invasion and war without the participation of the chief executive of Ukraine. What I see that happened on Friday was, in a sense, a kind of a reverse version of that, or a negative image version of that, in the sense that this involved Zelensky but did not involve the Russian Federation. So it's completely unclear what Russia's commitment to this peace deal was on Friday. Apparently, the Trump administration wanted, among other things, not just the signing of the mineral deal, but also that the Ukrainian military would stand down, right, that it would withdraw from the battlefield. But there was no commensurate or corresponding promise coming from the Russian Federation. They were actually not in the loop at all with what happened on Friday. Now, Trump emphasized that he had some kind of verbal promise from Putin, but this is really, you know, very much a red herring, and we don't even know what that verbal promise was. So from Zelensky's perspective, it made complete sense that he would turn down this offer, which had no promises of any kind of stability or peace at all.
So a couple of questions about the – first of all, now many in the Republican Party, including the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, are calling for the resignation of Volodymyr Zelensky. What would that solve?
It would solve nothing. It would solve nothing. I think that this is essentially a kind of a way of signaling support of Trump's position on all of this. I don't think it's necessarily even a serious suggestion. It's really a kind of a verbal talisman, simply indicating that they're on board with the Trump administration, although they may not be in agreement with every single detail.
It seemed that anything that Zelensky said in that meeting was immediately misunderstood and turned around and was and then Trump just went off and got very loud and boisterous. And I'm still trying to figure out exactly why Zelensky is, you know, they're talking about what he wore. Hello, Elon Musk. But then also just the fact that here is a guy who has you know, was being chastised for not saying thank you enough when he's on the record for thanking the American people, for thanking the country, for thanking the leadership over and over and over and over again. And then again, of not understanding that this was something about just a blanket thank you instead of about the lives at stake in the war. That even though Trump mentioned it as you're talking about World War III, I'm confused by that. You don't have any cards. It seems like he has some cards.
Yes, he does have some cards. I mean, he has, of course, the card, you know, in the back pocket of European support. You know, they've actually been very generous with military aid during this entire conflict since the very moment of the Russian invasion in February 22. He also has, you know, I think, great deal of sympathy across the political spectrum in the United States. I mean, it is surprising how many Trump voters still regard, according to a recent Wall Street Journal survey, still regard Russia as being fundamentally in the wrong in this conflict, and that Putin is the aggressor.
You mentioned Riyadh, but also go to the UN vote. And which is just, I mean, stunning. I mean, absolutely stunning that the United States would, on the day of the anniversary, would not support Ukraine. And I'm curious as to how someone like President Zelensky comes in and tries to, of what he thought he could do, and ultimately at least have people. It seemed like he was walking in thinking he perhaps could have a sane conversation. And that obviously wasn't going to happen, especially once Vice President Vance jumped in.
Yeah, he thought he was going to have a sane conversation. I mean, of course, Trump, being as transactional as he is, has occasionally signaled some sympathy for the Ukrainian position, however half-hearted, but still. Vance, on the other hand, has been solidly opposed to any kind of aid to Ukraine, military or otherwise. And I think that Zelensky, being a former comedian and an actor, he was very aware of his role as somebody who could, make a bid for sympathy for the world at large and for the American public. I think that was definitely a part of it. One of the reasons why he wasn't entirely successful in that regard was, frankly, his command of English, which is pretty good. But to be bombarded in a situation like that with such high stakes is a very difficult situation for anyone, even if you're operating within your own native language, which he wasn't.
I want to ask one more question, then we'll take a break and we'll get to the rest of our panelists on this. But I think you look at this situation and you wonder just how... I mean, at the beginning, I was thinking that it was almost irreparable, the damage that was done. Mm. I don't know that given the support of European allies to Ukraine over the weekend. How do you feel about that? Because you have a president and a vice president of the United States who were line for line using the talking points of Vladimir Putin and were supporting Vladimir Putin and did not seem to have a very firm grasp as to what the situation was.
I think you've really, Joe, hit upon the main problem. They did not have a firm grasp of the situation at all. One of the faulty assumptions of the mineral deal that Trump and Vance wanted Zelensky to sign was that if the United States becomes very closely involved economically on the ground level with Ukraine in extracting these resources, that would be a sufficient guarantee for the Russian Federation not to invade, because the Russian Federation and the United States would be on a better footing. But this is a faulty assumption for one very, and I just want to touch upon this very quickly, it's really important. The fact of the matter is that China and the Russian Federation have relatively good economic relations right now. In fact, many of the businesses, Western businesses that were in the Russian Federation that left because of the sanctions, that vacuum has been filled by Chinese companies and corporations. In spite of that, the Russian Federation bombed a port city, Mykolaiv, that had a very important Chinese investment from the company Kofco. And that did not serve as any kind of disincentive. The fact that those two countries were getting along fine economically, Russia and China, did not prevent Russia from bombing that very important economic hub on the Black Sea coast. So I think that Zelensky really has... he has a firm knowledge of what the situation on the ground level is. And really, Vance and Trump were dealing in kind of hollow abstractions.
Well, and a pettiness, right? I mean, just a pettiness over that this whole thing came down to how dare you not say thank you.
Of course, of course. Look, I get it. Trump and Vance want a feather in their cap to say that they accomplished this peace, right? That this historic moment will be thanks to them. I get it. But for that to happen, it has to be realistic. And under the conditions of this deal that they were offering Zelensky, it was not realistic. I'm kind of surprised that they were not at all cognizant of the way that this could very easily blow up in their face, given that there was absolutely no security guarantee from the side of the Russian Federation, and that they would presumably simply not attack because their friend, the United States, was now, very closely allied in economic terms with Ukraine. That's a very faulty assumption.
Professor Alexander Mihailovich is our guest, along with our panel this morning, and a professor emeritus at Hofstra University. Let me get to the rest of the group here, and then we'll go to a break. But, Teresa.
Well, I have questions.
Okay. All right.
I have comments, but questions on the same vein you were. One of the things that I understood, and I don't understand a lot, is the territory where the rare earth metals are primarily. Russia has seized a lot of the property nearby.
Yes.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so that creates this potentially very touchy dynamic. And Zelensky wanted the U.S. to get Putin to push back away from there. But of course, they want to hold that area because they want the rare earths. Can you speak to the dynamic that that creates? And wasn't Putin trying to push further in to gain more territory, to gain more of the rare earths? Or just if you could, if you have any insights about that dynamic in the area where the rare earths are.
Okay. So let me just say, for starters, that the territory that the Russian Federation is currently occupying Russia has occupied that territory not primarily because of the rare earth resources. It has occupied that territory because they see it as having military strategic value. This would give them all, this gives them practically the, it gives them the entire Azov coast, of the Azov Sea, and most of the Black Sea coast.
So they're not pushing back unless they get forced back.
They're not pushing back until, unless they're getting forced back. Their primary reason for being there is really, broadly speaking, territorial and strategic rather than economic. All right. Now, having said that, it does seem that roughly up to 40% of the rare earth resources of Ukraine are located in those four districts.
That are held by Russia.
Held by Russia. I mean, broadly speaking, held by Russia. There are pockets here and there that are held by the Ukrainian forces. All right. So it's rather obscure what deal Trump was working on with Putin, because it seems that what he had in mind was some kind of economic cooperation where he would obtain access to those mineral sources through the Russian Federation itself.
This was going to be my follow-up question, because Putin and Russia said something after, in response, they were saying something about a week ago about, you know, doing some deal with the U.S. About rare earths, and it seemed like it was in the in this area that they have seized from Ukraine, and I that's what I wanted to, like, what's going on there?
Yeah, I think that, you know, Trump perceives this as a win-win. If he gives Putin what he wants, if he gives him those four territories, from it basically extends from eastern Ukraine to southeastern Ukraine. If he gives those four territories, then there is a form of peace, but there's also access that Putin would, you know, offer him to some of those rare mineral resources. The mineral resources that are present in Ukraine and other parts of the country outside of the coastline in East Ukraine, that could be something agreed upon between the United States and Ukraine itself. All right. So he sees this probably as a win-win. He could, he'll deal with both countries, both with Russia and Ukraine, and he'll be able to obtain those mineral resources from both countries. All right. With the agreement that Russia would simply, you know, obtain those four regions that it considers to be a part of its territory already. By the way, those four regions, if you go to any map of the Russian Federation, you know, issued by the Russian Federation in various languages, they are all four now considered to be districts of that country rather than Ukraine.
But then isn't this just a recipe for Russia to do what everyone anticipates they're doing, which is just going to keep rolling over land, and that would be a prime area for them to keep rolling into if they decide to renege?
That's a conclusion that many Russians on the side of the Putin government would not disagree with, actually. what's interesting is that right now much of the bombardment is happening actually in that narrow segment of land between the Crimean and Peninsula and Moldova. And this is the so-called grain corridor of Ukraine. It's Odessa and Nikolaev. I've mentioned already Nikolaev is a port city where there was, you know, a Chinese company, Kofco, was, you know, had a concern there, and they essentially had to, you know, scale back their operations because of the invasion, in spite of all sorts of, you know, economic agreements between Russia and China that are fundamentally friendly. But they're very interested in that segment of land because of its strategic value. These are port cities. And if the Russian Federation were to obtain those two districts, Odessa and Mykolaiv, they would have the entire Black Sea coast, right? And this is indeed what many, many propagandists and advisors, in Putin's party, Russia United, this is what, they're advocating for.
But aren't those ports, they're obviously important to Ukraine, but aren't they important to the U.S. and other countries around the world because of the exports that come out of there, particularly food?
Yes, they are
because
very important.
Because Ukraine is a breadbasket for so many, right?
Yeah. Now, it's not the breadbasket that it was, unfortunately, because of the invasion and because of the motion detector mines that the Russian army has planted in many of the fields. What Ukraine
and
has,
the U.S. has just cut back, by the way, as an aside, the funding in the State Department for mine clearing, by the way, just generally around the world.
Yeah.
Which is shameful. Thank you, Doge.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's a really,
it's a very serious problem. I was talking to a friend who is actually in Ukraine now about how dangerous that is, both for Ukraine and other places around the world.
So this would be very, it's obviously, in terms of the global economy, potentially very highly destabilizing, partly because, among other things, Middle Eastern countries, until the invasion, were getting much of their wheat and sunflower from Ukraine.
And sunflower is oil that we need for cooking and stuff.
Yeah.
And so when people say we have no interest there and that it's the Europeans' problem, it's not our problem, that's not true. That's a lack of understanding about the global, I guess I want to put this in a form of question, about the global interconnections.
Yeah,
so when those folks in the Oval Office, we're acting as if we're just doing a big favor for them, it's a lack of understanding about the interconnections.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think that, it's going to affect the price of wheat. It already has. And it's not necessarily a good thing for the American farmer, I would say,
right.
Obviously. Mm-hmm. I think that there's not a lot of long-range thinking in these terms. That's my conclusion.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll hear from both Jennifer and Libby and continue this discussion. We welcome your input. We are getting many letters. We'll get to those. We'll spend some time with the letters today so we hear from a lot of folks about what is occurring. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning, we are talking about an event that happened on Friday where the Oval Office meeting between President Trump, Vice President J.D. Vance, and Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky went off the rails and turned into a showdown. And we've been discussing that. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. There are so many aspects to this story, so many of which I want to get to through the course of our time together. We heard from Professor Mihailovich. We heard from Teresa Bourgeois. Jennifer Burns.
Okay, so first, I think we have to, and the media has to be careful of continuing to scold Vladimir. His name just evacuated.
Zelensky. Volodymyr Zelensky.
Yes, to scold him for somehow not being prepared or not folding and complying with the communication that is necessary to speak and honor Trump, right? It's like victim blaming when somebody's dealing with an abuser or a bully, right?
It's such an interesting point that you make because I've heard on more than one occasion of people who were generally horrified by what happened still said he should have went in there and said
Zelensky, he should have done
what he
Trump
should have
wanted.
Done this,
he should have
this,
folded
this,
and
this,
complied and,
this.
And acquiesced to the bully. And that, go ahead, what were you going to say? Okay, I should go. But that kind of thing implies over and over that Zelensky was doing something wrong. And he was not. He went in to have a conversation where they have been left out of other ones. Mm. He is dressed, and Teresa's big on this, and I agree, in a show of solidarity to the Ukrainian soldiers and to those who have been fighting in the war. He is part of the people.
Which is nothing new.
Right? It's not new. It is a continued, steady sort of demonstration of where his loyalty lies and what he's working for. And to continue to kind of say he should have been more prepared, he should have folded, he should have done, especially when you have Trump saying one thing, then you have J.D. Vance jumping off the couch practically, you know, almost, you know, showing a physical, almost like attack kind of threat. You have Rubio sitting there. The whole thing was such a spectacle, and it plays into the disinformation that people want to continue to believe that somehow the U.S. is still this strong man led, in charge, knowing of all these intricacies, that really it's just a performance in this way. It's not really to have positive communication. It's to hit a, be a bully and to hit the guy that's down to sort of continue to justify while you're going to work with this other guy over here, which is Putin, to bulldoze the ideologies of mm-hmm. freedom and democracy, right? I mean, that was my take on it.
I couldn't get over the fact that you have a president of a country who is at war. Mm-hmm. They were invaded. They're trying to keep their people alive. They're fighting for their lives, and this guy who's trying to defend them, literally, and I think this has to be said over and over and over again, literally gets kicked out of the White House. Mm. I mean, here's your hat. Mm. Goodbye. Yep. And that is, I mean, none of that should be normalized in any way, shape, or form of saying that that's just Trump being Trump. Mm. That is a situation where, you know, tempers got, tempers started to flare. I mean, that is a performative or not. Mm. The end result was the president of Ukraine was thrown out of the White House with mm. full support then going to Vladimir Putin.
It's the optics and the scolding, mm. right? Like, you're not prepared. You can't lead your country's war. You're not good enough. It's that kind of...
You're being disrespectful. Right. You owe us
you
an
are
apology.
The little one, and you need. We need to teach you how to... Sorry, to run these kind of things. It implies all of that, I think. I mean, whether it's true or not is not really the case. It's not true, but it implies that, and people run with it. They'll lose this interest in backing Ukraine, or they'll be so intimidated by the president and the vice president and others that they'll just go along like Lindsey Graham. They'll flip, and they'll just go along. You should have done better kind of thing.
Oh, Lindsey.
Sorry, Libby.
Miss Lindsey just goes along to get along. But, I mean, look, all anybody has to do is watch the live open of Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. And you will see exactly what happened in that meeting. I mean, we all watched it on the news. We all were just totally astounded. Yeah. But it really was like J.D. Vance playing the schoolyard bully to Trump's, you know, gang leader.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? And J.D. Vance is showing how macho he can be because he's not really. And so he wanted everyone to know how macho he could be, and you should thank us. Like, the issue here is this. Zelensky thanked the United States. It was under a different president who these two don't recognizes being
well. He had thanked the United States earlier in the day. I mean,
he opened his comments by saying thank you.
I get it. But it's not.
That's
it's not,
not
the,
issue. The
groveling that Trump wanted. Trump wants people to get on their knees and grovel.
Go ahead, Teresa.
I also think it's important to keep in mind the context here of where you have Trump and his minions for the last couple of weeks saying totally incorrectly that Zelensky is a dictator.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes. They said Zelensky provoked the war. Mm-hmm. There was this whole buildup that has tried to elevate Putin and denigrate Zelensky.
Mm-hmm.
And Zelensky, not only wasn't he disrespectful, but he put that aside.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a certain, and then for Graham to say, well, I told him,
right.
You know, I told him not to do that. I mean, I told him not to face the truth. But there, as you know, there's mm-hmm. a core issue here in the actual negotiations that, you know, it's the security agreements.
Mm-hmm.
And he also, when Trump went off and lied again, more disinformation, mm-hmm. saying that the NATO allies, the European allies, you know, we've given $320 billion, mm. and they've only given $110 billion,
mm.
and they're getting theirs back. He repeats it over and over. The number's not even close. Mm. Collectively, they've given more than the U.S. Mm. Collectively, the U.S. has given about $120-130 billion.
It's $120 billion in terms of military aid, mm-hmm. And roughly 60 or 55 billion in terms of humanitarian and other kinds of aid.
But the question is, have we ever, ever, ever asked any country that we've given military aid to or humanitarian aid to pay us back?
It's no. It's no. No. But
it's a shakedown.
It's like the fire company, like, right. Hey, we put the fire out in your house.
Yeah, so now you need to pay us.
Here's the bill.
Right.
Yeah, that's not
how
that works.
This is, you know, you pay your taxes and that's how that works.
But well, I do think he's not used at all to having people correct him. And I think that Zelensky very appropriately, And then he kept saying, well, you know, security agreements, we have to get this agreement done first, and then we'll talk about security.
Mm-hmm.
Well, security is fundamental to the agreement.
Mm-hmm. Right. It was a part of the agreement. Actually, Zelensky had already agreed to the mineral deal part of the agreement, which I should tell you, by the way, is rather extractive and exploitive and is not particularly in the interest of Ukraine.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Essentially, they would obtain money for reconstruction through the interest that's accrued from the deal.
The gains.
And so, but in fact, the amount of money that Ukraine would need for reconstruction is $524 billion, right? Which over a 10-year period, you know. So they want, Trump loves spectacle.
Mm-hmm,
right.
Mm-hmm.
He loves visuality. Right. In fact, Zelensky went into that meeting in some ways trying to persuade Trump, to sway him, to move him by showing him a picture book of civilian and horrific military deaths from the Ukrainian side. Trump took a look at it and he said, wow, that is really tough. Okay, fine. But the problem here is fundamentally that the spectacle is always a part of these gatherings in the White House, regardless of what administration mm-hmm. it is. But the problem here was that the deal was not finished.
Right.
The security segment of the agreement was still being written and rewritten as Zelensky was sitting there in the Oval Office with Trump and Vance. Naturally, of course, he wasn't going to agree to something that he hadn't seen or read yet. That's just par for the course. But they really did this ass backwards. Mm-hmm. They wanted to have first the spectacle, and then they wanted to have, you know, the details hashed out with the security agreement. And of course, you know, just as any advocate for civilian and military population, Zelensky was not going to sign off on something that he didn't know the details of.
And doesn't this get to a larger issue that you're seeing also now in the Middle East, that Trump just does not have a strong national security team in place and operating well, and he's disrupted the State Department? I mean, to me, that showed bad leadership and bad staffing. And I think if you step back and think about the campaign, what did he say over and over there? Three key things in the campaign. We're going to bring food prices down, right? Mm-hmm. Food inflation, number one. immigration, we're going to stop immigration. Mm-hmm. We're going to deport 100 million mm-hmm. people, right? And number three, we're going to bring peace. And this war would, he says over and over, with no basis in fact, this war would have never happened if I'd been there. And it would never mm-hmm. happen, never happen, never happen. Well, he's there now, and Russia's still bombing. Mm-hmm. So that's not true. He's there now, and look what's going on in Gaza, and look what's going on in the West Bank, right? And I the second half of the deal in the West Bank and Gaza, you know, is not moving forward at all because they're not leading the negotiations in the same way the Biden team, which was a very good team, was leading it, right? And he's food prices are going up, right? Inflation's going up. So number one, he's not winning on that one. Mm-hmm. Big negotiator, he's a winner. He's not winning. Number two, immigration, that's not going so well. You know, he has shut down some, but no money. The courts are stopping him. That's not going so well. And I think this is not going well. And what the performative part, I think, has been trying to turn it on to Zelensky, as if Zelensky's mm-hmm. the problem. It's not his negotiation skills. He wants to make this, you know, he wants to make this Zelensky's failure, not his. Mm-hmm. I think it was blame shifting, which mm-hmm. was going on.
Yeah,
there.
Oh, yeah. It was complete blame shifting. And I think, you know, really the problem of security was central to Zelensky's disinclination to agree to this deal. What really stuck in his craw, from what I can tell from Russian language and Ukrainian language sources, news sources, is the demand that the Trump administration had that Ukraine should withdraw from the battlefield, right, regardless mm-hmm. of what the Russian Federation does. And I was, you know,
and the Europeans can't like that either, right?
No,
that's the rolling mm-hmm. through it.
Yeah,
right.
No. Now the closest that I've been able to figure out in terms of the thinking or reasoning that the Trump administration had about this point of the withdrawal of Ukraine from the battlefield and the standing down of their troops is something that I read this morning. It was a statement by the UK ambassador to the United States, Peter Mendelssohn, who's, if I remember correctly, a former member of parliament who's conservative.
Yes.
And he said, "I think that Ukraine should be the first to commit to a ceasefire and defy Russia to follow." Now, that is simple. Russia will not follow, you know. They have no reason to.
They yeah,
have,
why would they?
Right.
So,
why would they do that?
So this is, so as far as I can tell, this seems to have been the line of reasoning. Because of this close personal relationship or solidarity or bromance that Putin and Trump have in Trump's mind, because of this shared narcissistic wound they have.
And this, of course, mm-hmm. obviously, when Zelensky went through all of the previous agreements that Putin mm-hmm. had reneged on, then Trump's like, well, he's my friend, so he's not going to renege on this one, which
yeah.
is meaningless.
Yeah, which is not yeah. true.
Now, what about the issue with China here, too? Doesn't this embolden China? Like, eliminating USAID funding certainly emboldens China. But doesn't this embolden China in some way, strengthen their hand?
It does, probably. I think it strengthened their hand territorially more than economically, because Ukraine, if Russia essentially gets what it wants, which is a neutral Ukraine with a limited army, no NATO membership, and those four areas which comprise roughly 19% of the entire territory of Ukraine ceded to the Russian Federation, you will have essentially a kind of useful precedent for China moving more openly towards the annexation of Taiwan.
I want to take a break, and when we come back, I want to continue the discussion. I want to get to letters. I also want to just, I don't know that we can do this, but so now what? you know, where do we go? Where does this go from here? Short term, long term, and have a discussion about that. We welcome you, as always, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Teresa Bourgeois is here, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, Alexander Mihailovich, who is the author of the new book, A Liberal Vanguard, Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia, which is about the confluence of American and Russian far-right populist movements. We're going to talk about the book in depth coming up at about 10:45. We'll take a break. Ray Graff will have news and much more. Persis. It just seems like a Frank Zappa kind of morning. Yeah. I'm glad we're playing that this morning. It just seems right. You can catch all the tracks by going to the website and looking at the playlist, wamc.org/roundtable. The Academy Awards were last night about, I don't know, two-thirds way through the broadcast. The host of the broadcast, Conan O'Brien, said the film Anora is having a good night, which is great. Several wins already. I guess Americans are excited to see someone finally stand up to a powerful Russian. Really the only political joke of the night, but yeah. A really good one.
A very good one.
Yes. But I do think, it does bring us to this point about standing up to Russia. So I ended the last segment by saying, so what do we do now? Where are we? I mean, as the meetings take place in Europe and there's more and more support for Zelensky amongst European allies and people continue, and rightfully so, questioning our commitment, then what does that mean for a playbook, or even is there a playbook for the Trump administration on this, which I guess brings us to the not the State of the Union, but the meeting of the joint session of Congress that's taking place tomorrow night that the president will be speaking at at 9 p.m., which we, of course, will be broadcasting here on WAMC. Mm-hmm. Alexander, what do you think?
I think that there is a kind of silver lining to this, which is that the European Union and the countries of the European Union individually will become more invested and interested and active in the security of Ukraine. And I think that there's, many of Trump's, threats against NATO as an institution, his criticisms of it, that the countries are not paying their share. As a result of those comments from the first Trump administration, the European countries have actually raised the level of their contribution to NATO. And that's not a bad thing. And they're more in a position to effect a realistic peace in Ukraine than the United States is. For one thing, they have much closer ties with the Russian Federation economically, and they're able to put more pressure upon it in a way that the United States is not. They're closer to the territory of Ukraine, and so they'd be able to act more quickly in terms of its security interests. I think that the future is there, really. We need to sort of look, in a sort of positive way about the possibility of the European Union really, in some sense, pushing back against the Russian Federation, which they do have the capability to make real because of their economic leverage primarily.
Anyone else on that?
Well, I do think it was an important image the right after to leave and go see that Zelensky was with, surrounded by key European leaders who had his back, right? Yeah. And said, we're all in this together. It matters to us. And I also think it's important to remember that that, you know, Trump had weakened that NATO coalition. Mm. And one of the things that the Biden national security team and Biden's leadership is to bring them together and make them stronger. And I think Obama, President Obama, had started to say, you need to provide more funding, right? And they, so they had started to do that under the Obama administration. Trump did it in a public bullying way, so that we became more aware of it. But I also think that in terms of getting them to work more clearly and coherently together, I think that the response that they were able to make so quickly over the weekend, that was grown over time under the leadership of the Biden national security team. But what it also shows is that it's basically the U.S. is left to the side, right? And we, because we appear to be negotiating with Russia against them in some way, not in the middle. It's not a position of power. And so I think that the question is, where is the U.S. left in all of this? Because as I think you so deftly pointed out, that the president and the vice president and the national security team, as my father would say, doesn't seem to have an understanding of the seriousness of the situation. You know, that they really don't have the depth of knowledge and awareness. And so I don't know where, I think it does not bode well for the U.S. in terms of our relations, understanding that our relations with Ukraine, like Rubio and Trump and the others say, well, we need to get out of this. And maybe I'm repeating myself, but we need to get out of this so that we can focus on China, without understanding how interrelated it all truly is. But I do think you see that the Europeans are going to have their back. Now, they're never going to have enough resources in the kinds of weapon systems and stuff that the U.S. can provide. But I also worry about what does this mean for U.S. intelligence gathering. And I was troubled to see, you know, with some show of fanfare and victory yesterday, Friday, when Trump was leaving for Mar-a-Lago, after going to the microphones and denigrating Zelensky again, they talked about the fact that on the plane were all the classified documents that the FBI had seized from Mar-a-Lago, that they're going back to Mar-a-Lago. And that just is a reminder of the precariousness with which they handle national security information. And so you have a combination of what does that say to people around the world who give us information, and you have the State Department cutting funding and cutting people who are doing cybersecurity against Russia. They were just told to stand down about cybersecurity against Russia, which I think is very concerning. And so these various alliances and information gathering, you know, Trump promised peace and security, but all these steps, this is what keeps me up at night. All of these steps seem to be making us less secure and having fewer friends around the world. So
I'm baffled by the what Trump believes to be the economic dividend that the United States would obtain from improving relations with Russia. It makes absolutely no sense, because previously
may I be snarky?
Yeah,
it has nothing to do with the United States.
Right? Is it?
It has to do with him.
Obviously.
Yeah.
But he's somebody who also insists.
Libby was snarky for me.
Anytime, Joe.
But we're not.
But the thing is this: we can all wring our hands about all this international stuff all day long. Rank and file Americans, they don't care. They don't. Eggs are still high, right? Inflation is going up. The market is not doing well. They're not going to be better off this year than they were
tariffs are
3 years
raise
ago, 4 years ago. So ultimately, it's going to be the economic impact of all of this that's going to impact Trump and the 2026 midterm elections.
Right. But
that's where I'm going. That's what I'm focusing on, is the 2026 midterm elections. The economy is going to tank because this man is not doing anything, because he doesn't know what he's doing, and he thinks he does. And so
he's not a good negotiator. But don't you think that the getting out of USAID not only has national security implications, but it has economic implications.
Oh, absolutely.
Because
absolutely,
if you're not tracking Ebola, if you're not tracking all these other things, it's health concerns.
Teresa, right? You understand that. We understand that. The vast uneducated that Trump loves does not. They'll understand it when their kids get Ebola in the Appalachia. That's when they'll understand it.
But if you put tariffs on China, everything at Walmart's going to cost more.
I get it. I get it. Right. I understand that. But that's all they're going to see. They're not going to make these major connections. They're just going to see, geez, it's costing me more for clothes and eggs, and I can't put clothes on my kids' back to send them back to school, and all of that sort of, like, we can't go to Disney, we can't do any of it because things are costing too much. That's what's going to impact people. The foreign policy part of this is for people who track on that, and the vast majority, as painful as it is, do not track on that. Yeah, what's going on in Ukraine, what Trump is doing to Zelensky doesn't seem fair. But until it has an economic impact here at home, you're not going to see people in the streets.
But I think that's why we need to make the connection, though, because like you say, the wheat, you know, it's the breadbasket, the wheat, right? And mm-hmm. and where are you going to get the rare earths? And what mm-hmm. are you going to do about, you know, okay, so we're going to put tariffs on lumber for Canada mm-hmm. at a time when we have a major housing crisis. So we're going to get rid of half of HUD, that's what they want to do. Mm-hmm. They want to eliminate half of the HUD,
yeah,
Housing and Urban Development, right?
Yeah.
They're pulling back on contracts that have already been granted about building houses. And now you're going to make wood more expensive. And they say, well, mm-hmm. we're going to replace it by cutting timber in U.S. National forests. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. But our timber manufacturing has been shut down over the last couple of years. It would take a couple of years to reignite our timber right. manufacturing.
One thing that would happen as a result of a trade war between China and the United States with the imposition of tariffs that Trump is threatening is that would really drive China straight into the arms of the Russian Federation in terms of economic alliances. China already has a significant foothold, you know, in terms of a business profile mm-hmm. in the Russian Federation. Heck, largely many of the Western businesses that left beginning in 2014 and well into the sanctions, you know, those Western businesses were filled by Chinese businesses and corporations. If you have a trade war, China will simply, you know, engage more closely economically with Russia. And what you will have really is a kind of a bipolar world. I mean, you hear all these people on the far right in this country and in European countries, you know, parties like the AFD, Vox in Spain, in the UK, the so-called Reform Party. You know, they're all
they're
all fairly, you know, racist and nativist in various ways. And they constantly critique the establishment of a neoliberal global order. All right. We don't want that. We want a multipolar world. But what you are going to get as a result of a trade war with China is really something like a return to the Cold War, but resulting in a world that is not ideologically divided, but divided in terms of economic imperiums, right? And this is really not obviously this is not in the interest of the average consumer in the United States. Prices will go up, right? It's going to affect down sort of like the whole supply chain, it seems to me, and will also be affected. It'll also be, you know, reflected in things such as real estate prices.
We do have many, many letters, and I want to get to those in the time we have remaining. I'm going to go bottom up here, meaning that the ones that came in first and go to the top. Which is more for me to know than you, but here we go. It's just a reminder.
Like
so, like, if I say it out loud, maybe I'll actually remember to do it. That's sort of my idea there. Bob said, who had control over whether the meeting would be held as a public meeting? It seems inadvisable to have such a meeting in front of cameras and the public. Did the Ukrainians have any choice in the matter, or were they required to attend regardless of the setting? Well, at the very end, President Trump said, wow, that
we made some really good television, which sort of told me everything that I need.
That's all you need to know.
To know, right? Yeah. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
Right.
And
it
just,
was a setup.
It was a setup. And I also want to point out that the correspondent for the Russian state media was there, as was the Ukrainian ambassador to the United States.
Yeah.
So it was this setup. Is this
whose head was in her hands.
Yeah.
And remember, the Associated Press was not allowed in.
Yeah.
But the Russian state media recording it, live streaming it, as I understand it.
Yes.
Think
yes.
about that.
So I think it was partly for I mean, some of this was for their benefit, and also the spectacle of this sort of humiliation of both Zelensky, so-called humiliation. I actually think this blew up in their faces, but, you know, that's another thing to parse down the line. But, you know, the humiliation of Zelensky and his representative, the ambassador, that she was there, and, you know...
It's an anomaly. It's like... This is not how you do business. This is not how we've ever done business. But since it's Trump's White House, we're going to do business like we've never done before. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's his thing. We're going to do all this business. But how we treat people, how we... This was a setup for Zelensky. Mm-hmm. Since when do we let the Russian media into the Oval Office?
Russian state.
Well, yes. Also,
when does that happen? How often has that happened?
When do you have a press conference about a deal before you've had
axed
the discussion?
Deal?
I mean,
well,
that's the kicker.
Right. Yeah.
For me, you know.
That's why it seemed so staged to me. At first I thought, oh my goodness. And then when he said what he said at the end about it being good TV, and then when I heard that they let Russian state TV.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel a little conspiratorial, but... It just seemed performative. Again, blame shifting. I think it's a deal that he realizes he can't make because the Europeans are not going to let him give away Ukraine. Mm. And I think he's looking for a way out, shifting the blame to him. But
Neil says, during the post-war Cold War, Russians called American communist members and sympathizers useful idiots. Well, we see that happening again. Chris says, let's not forget what was promised to Ukraine in the 1994 agreement. They give up their nukes.
Yes.
Nothing else matters.
That's right.
The Russia Budapest Memorandum,
is in the wrong, and so is Trump. We have a couple mentions of that memorandum. Then we go to Jerome, who says, I think if you look at what happened in Friday's Oval Office meeting from the standpoint that Trump and Vance never wanted an agreement with President Zelensky, if you think of this of it in this way, if they blow up the deal with Zelensky, they have a pretext to drop support for Ukraine, get in bed with Putin, and after Putin overruns Ukraine, they still have access to the mineral rights. I think that's what played out on Friday. Your thoughts? Mm-hmm. Well, I think we generally agree with that assessment.
Yeah.
So,
but the question is Europe alliance, this is what I'm not sure, are they strong enough to try to guard against that?
I think potentially they are. I mean, they would have to increase the sizes of their militaries, maybe in some cases even put in some kind of draft, which may not be popular, but it may be essential.
And the other question for the U.S. is, are enough Republicans, which I haven't seen that in the last 48 hours, that can say, listen, this is not who we are. We're on the wrong side of the negotiation table. We need to do something about this.
They won't.
I don't see that.
They
happening.
Won't happen. That won't happen. They're all scared of
That's
Trump.
Never happened.
That's never going to happen.
All right, Rick says, I think you need to accept the fact at this point that Trump is not playing by the rules that you all find normal. He has positioned himself to completely overrun all of our conventions. He certainly wants to declare martial law so he can cancel courts and midterm elections. Our only hope is a military coup. Doesn't that sound counterintuitive? It's the truth. He has already begun defying judges, and he will also defy Congress. He also put his stooges in strategic places within the military. But I don't think there are enough of them. He swore an oath to the Constitution, though he strategically kept his hand off of the Bible. One could only hope that with Milley as the sacrificial martyr, there will be enough fortitude within the higher ranks of the military to put an end to this bubbling up reign of terror. I thought I would toss in a really scary letter there.
A little trivia.
Yes.
Tomorrow is the anniversary of the U.S. Constitution going into effect. 1789, 236 years ago tomorrow, it was established by Congress and our Constitution went into effect. On the night he's giving his speech where he's, you know, sort of tearing apart. How would you describe it, Jennifer? What's he doing? What is he doing to our Constitution?
He's putting it down the toilet.
Yeah.
It's just that simple.
You know, as I'm sitting here, am I oversimplifying this or in the sense that what I think or what I'm sensing is that this is Trump's vision of like a territorial imperialism for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Am I right? Like that he doesn't have to necessarily get a hold of the land in Ukraine, but economically it's like settling the land in Ukraine where he's pulling out the minerals, right? Like, so it's like an expansion where China's going into Africa and other nations are moving the actual tangible land they have, right? It's almost like a post-colonial colonialism without the actual fencing off of your zone.
No, that's an excellent, that's a very good way of putting it.
Thank you.
You know, I haven't heard it expressed so succinctly, you know, and what you're saying it's very familiar to me, and parts of it are very familiar from what leftists and Ukraine are saying, that what Trump wanted to accomplish with the mineral deal was something like the 18th century European land grab of African territory.
Yeah, it's like a scramble for Africa. That's what it reminded me of.
It also reminds me a little bit of the United States was doing under President McKinley in the Philippines. And of course, you know, Trump has mentioned, I mean, to the extent that he reads anything about American history, I guess he has some advisors who sort of point him in certain directions, that, you know, McKinley is, you know, one of his is a predecessor that he feels very comfortable, whose legacy he feels very comfortable with. So, but yes, exactly. I mean, this is, you know, thank God that Zelensky didn't sign that, because so the mineral deal is now off the table, because that was a part of this, you know, whole complex of agreements that included security. But the fact that the security agreement was so unfavorable, he simply didn't sign it, and so this for the time being is not happening.
And can I do you think that Trump feels, well, if he gets the rare earth minerals from Zelensky, from Ukraine, or from Putin, he doesn't care who owns the land. He just think about the picture of the swearing in where all of the tech owners were standing behind him, you know, and they need the rare earths, right? That's who needs the rare earths to drive our tech economy. And so whether he gets them from Putin or he gets them from Ukraine, he doesn't care. He just needs them for those guys.
Right.
And they want him. I mean, and what they are looking at is becoming the oligarchs of the 21st century. Without any regard to free speech, they want to control the...
Some of them.
Most of them. I would say the big ones, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Zuckerberg.
Yes.
Right? I mean, I think that's who we're dealing with. And Bezos doesn't have social media per se, but Amazon is its own entity and what he's doing to the Washington Post.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's really pretty disgusting. I have yet to, I can't say cancel my subscription because we read stuff from the Post. Yeah. From a journalistic point of view right now, it's still okay. It's the editorial part.
Right.
I think they're saying cancel subscription to the Washington Post. I wouldn't do that, but certainly don't buy from Amazon is a way to do it.
Oh, yeah. Let me get back to the letters here. We just have a couple of minutes. Peter says, is it a reasonable conclusion that Trump's adolescent tirade is just one more flood the zone muzzle velocity tactic on steroids to distract from the current public failings of Doge? I think Teresa made a similar point earlier. And John says, I think the reason why Europe was able to rally around Ukraine so quickly after Trump's attempt to bully Zelensky is that Europe has been preparing for this since November. They didn't sit around hoping things would work out, hoping that things wouldn't be as bad as they're becoming. They prepared for Trump. As a result, the U.S. will be sidelined from the world stage and made irrelevant. Well, we'll see, right? Mm.
I do think it's important if people stand on the side of Ukraine that there is public awareness that they do.
Final question before we go to the break, which is from Amy. How is what Trump is doing not treason? Can someone explain where that line is?
Whew.
All right, we'll let that hang in the air while
when
we go to a break.
When you're in charge of making the decision of what treason is, it's a little difficult when you've stacked the court, right, where they've already said he can do basically he's immune from everything. So
it's whether it's an official act or non-official act.
Well, I don't know how. I don't know about that.
We have 10 seconds, so let me just pause you there, and then we'll come back. We'll continue, and we'll wrap up our time together on this Monday morning right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alexander Mihailovich is with us. We also welcome Teresa Bourgeois, Jennifer Burns, and Libby Post. We will we got about 10 minutes or so left, and then Alexander and I are going to talk about his book and event coming up, and we'll continue on this theme a little bit. But as far as the panel goes, we have about 10 or 12 minutes left. I want to go back to some letters because I think they're interesting. One is, first of all, we're getting a lot of kudos and people thanking. People really like you, Alexander. So
thank you.
Come back.
Yeah. I'm glad.
I think what a great job you're doing in explaining all of this. So thank you very much for being with us and for doing this. Could the professor please explain the minerals deal a bit more and what this means? Major mining operations take years to develop between the exploration phase. That means Putin would have years of freedom to pummel Ukraine before there would be any significant American presence that might be a deterrent. Zelensky would have been a fool to sign under such a deal.
Yeah, well, I think the deal as a whole is not just about the minerals. Actually, what it does, it stipulates that there would be a fund, an investment fund, co-managed by Ukraine and the United States, and that what would, in addition to any profits from the extraction of minerals, any profits from certain resources of the of energy resources of Ukraine would also be a part of that. So, in other words, coal, gas, and what little oil there is in Ukraine that is owned by the state, 50% of that would go into the same fund as the minerals. All right. So, in other words, this is not just about the minerals. This is about energy and manufacturing resources writ large. Now, that some people, I think, correctly pointed out that the stipulation of 50% of state-owned energy resources being a part of that same fund is essentially a form of reparation against Ukraine. This is, you know, very exploitive.
Who does the extraction?
So, to be determined, apparently. Mm-hmm. And,
Ukraine or U.S. decides? Who decides who does it?
So that's an excellent question, mm-hmm. and I have to say I don't know. I
mean,
one would think if it's a fund that is co-managed by Ukraine and the United States on a 50-50 basis, that each would canvass potential companies and contractors, But that, too, was, left very vague, actually. So
they might not even know.
They might not even know. Right. And another aspect of this I just want to point out that's very important is that both Ukraine and Russia, prior to the beginning of this war, which is not 2022, but actually 2014, let me point this out, because that's when eastern Ukraine was invaded by Russian officers who did not have markings of rank or country on their uniforms. That's a very resource-rich area, and that in general, Ukraine has the largest untapped shale deposits of any country in the world. All right. So one question here is if those deposits that are, you know, those territories that are owned by the state for extraction, if that 50% of that goes into the same fund as the minerals, that opens up the possibility of fracking companies in the United States taking a very keen interest on being contractors or subcontractors of, you know, among the companies who would be chosen to do work in Ukraine. So I'm sorry, you know, I hope I, you know, I just wanted to sort of, you know, emphasize the extent to which, you know, the generally resource-rich profile of Ukraine is of keen interest to any number of players, countries right. within the European Union, Russia itself, and the United States.
Maria says, an absolutely fantastic discussion this morning in so many ways. Thank you for making it possible. Also, this from Mark, great guest and terrific panel. Please, can you ask Alexander if he has a theory as to why Trump is aligned with Russia in the first place?
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. Fareed Zakaria, you know, who coined the term liberal democracy, mm-hmm. you know, several years ago, you know, he has a theory that basically Trump respects only two kinds of countries, countries that are economic powerhouses, or countries that are dominated by kind of charismatic leaders who, you know, put on the show of being economic and political powerhouses globally. And I think, obviously, you know, the latter is, you know, the latter category is Putin, because, you know, Russia has a GDP which is the size of Italy. It is not a major economic player and never has been, really, within living memory. Its manufacturing sector collapsed, cratered during the 90s, partly thanks, I have to say, or no thanks to the United States, you know, which, you know, caused its economy to become completely ruined by economic shock mm-hmm. treatment theory. So, yeah, I think it's primarily temperamental. He likes Putin.
The other thing that I want to mention, and just as a wrap up, please discuss Pete Hegseth's order to halt offensive cyber operations against Russia. I find this frightening. We've mentioned this. I think all of us have mentioned it, certainly Alexander and Teresa were talking about it earlier. I mean, one point, which is a minor point, which is that this was in the works well before this meeting on Friday, and yet that doesn't make it any less scary, does it?
No. I was wondering if other people on the panel had anything to say about this. I mean, in regard to Hegseth himself and, you know, his way of thinking about international security.
Oh, Teresa.
I don't think any of these guys really think for themselves. Mm. They are there to serve the master. Mm. And that's really it. If Trump says we have to be nice to Vlad, right? Then everybody will do what they need to do to be nice to Vlad. In the Defense Department, it means we don't monitor them anymore. In the Agriculture Department, it means we let them get away with whatever they need to get away with. In economic development, the same thing. Foreign policy, let's get rid of USAID, because I'm sure Putin isn't happy with that either, because it's about building democracy, and he's all about tearing down liberal democracy. So I don't think they really think that much. I mean, I don't want to say that they're really morons, but I think that they do. They serve the king.
Well,
one
of the things that Secretary Rubio said to explain this was that it's a way, they're easing this as a way to get Putin to the table. Mm. And to me, that is just ridiculous to reason, right? Mm. Because it's compounded with all of the other things that they've been doing. And Rubio said, you're not going to bring them to the table if you're calling them names, if you're being antagonistic. Well, you know, I just, that jumped out at me in the article, because what is Trump been doing? Mm-hmm. He's been calling Zelensky mm-hmm. names, and he's yeah. been being antagonistic mm-hmm. to Zelensky. And so now they're saying, well, they're doing, taking all these steps, but they're taking a whole, this is just one piece of a much larger, deep, which I talked about earlier, deeply disturbing thing. And I will say, and I see a connection between these two. When Trump goes to the House of Representatives tomorrow night to deliver his speech, he will be doing that in the place where insurrectionists went in, many believe at his direction, and tried to overthrow, you know, to disrupt a peaceful transfer of power. And people were prosecuted, lawfully prosecuted for that. And they were arrested and sent to jail, and he pardoned them and called them hostages. And what did he do on Friday? Not only did he do all of this with Russia, but on Friday, they demoted more of the FBI agents and Justice Department staff who worked on this. So they have freed these people who tried to disrupt our, you know, our peaceful transfer of power.
Yeah.
They have let these other people go, and now they've demoted the people who prosecute them. At the same time, they are pulling back on the cybersecurity. They are saying to, they stopped the group of people in the Justice Department who were working on disinformation campaigns in Russia and monitoring Russian disinformation campaign in the U.S., and they have reduced the number of people in the CIA. Taken together, very, very deeply concerned.
I would just very quickly add, like, something that's very important, I think, is the ideological component, the anti-DEI element of Hexeth's, decisions, you know, in regard to women, in regard to minorities, in regard to also
trans people.
Trans people, and also LGBTQ, broadly speaking.
And going after higher education.
And going after higher education. These are things that that are very, how can I put it, congenial. To many people who are on the political right within the Russian Federation, they now, gay identity is essentially illegal. This has been happening as a kind of a drip, drip, drip within the parliament, the Duma, in the Russian Federation. But, you know, also, you know, there's this emphasis on traditional gender roles.
Yeah, masculinity.
That is masculinity that, you know, women essentially in the Russian Federation need to be breeders.
Right.
You know, so.
And people like Michael Johnson and the right in this country and even Trump feel the same way.
Yeah.
Can I add
we
one
should
thing?
Sit down and shut up and be pregnant and barefoot.
I think the other thing is, to me, this makes us also susceptible to threats on our domestic infrastructure even further. So there can be the campaigns into the sort of tribal, nablist, white supremacist, any other groups in the United States, because it won't be tracked, it won't be identified either with the cybersecurity over what Russia's doing. So they'll be able to infiltrate that way on the ground at a grassroots level in the U.S.
And we have the Musk people infiltrating our social, you know, our own. This, to me, I don't know why the American people aren't really distraught about this. Going into our social security information, our tax information. These folks have not been legally contracted to do this. They don't have security clearances. They don't have, to the best of my knowledge, they don't have non-disclosure clauses. They are being paid by outside companies who have an economic benefit in doing this.
There's also one thing that has been in the gay press and not necessarily in the rest of the press, and that is, I think it was in the Department of Defense or Homeland Security or something, they've taken, they are now allowed to surveil LGBT people. That was taken off the plate during Biden and I think prior to that as well. But now that protection of us not being able to be surveilled is off the table. So we can be watched. Our phones can be tapped. We can, you know, our bank accounts can be looked at. All of that. My Social Security can get looked at because I'm an out lesbian. And they are seeing us as the threats that Joe McCarthy made us into. In the 50s, where he was a closet case, as was
enemies within.
And I'm going to say my Pollyannish thing that I always say, that we are still a democracy, and we still have an opportunity to speak up. And it's an important thing that we do that. Listen tomorrow night. There will be disinformation, but the Democrats are bringing people who've been fired mm-hmm. and who are important to your lives. You know, speak up on behalf of the federal workers who work on behalf of you. Speak up on behalf of the universities, on the range of things. We need to get engaged, and we need to engage our elected officials at all levels of government.
Jennifer Burns, Teresa Bourgeois, Libby Post, you were all wonderful. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. We're going to continue conversation.
Thank you.
What a special guest.
Alexander about his new book, Illiberal Vanguard. We'll talk about that right after this short break.